You're listening to Business Matters. Over the past 10 years, one of the big growth businesses in America has been payday lending. If you're in the 37 states where this practice is legal, you can find a payday loan or check cashing office on almost every street corner in the poorer sections of town. What has fueled the rise of this industry? Why are consumer advocates and some legislators pushing for greater regulation? What is the right approach to credit for small, short-term loans? All that and more, just ahead.
Main Street, the main business street of a town.
From Jamaica to Japan, from Sri Lanka to Singapore, from Malaysia to Mexico, privatization is on the move.
What is business anyway?
Did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism?
You know what? Right now, breaking news here, stocks all around the world are tanking because of the
business provides the means of livelihood for most of the working population.
The risk takers, the doers, the makers of things.
Tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
Welcome to Business Matters. This is Thomas White.
And this is Jonah Meadows. And this week, we're tackling a subject that we talked about before on Business Matters, which is credit. How to get credit from banks, small banks, large banks. But one aspect of credit that we've never talked about before here on Business Matters is what are called short-term or installment loans, or more commonly, payday loans.
And one of the reasons we wanted to pay attention to this is because it's been a huge growth industry. There's a number of public companies who are in this business. It's franchised as well. And not to be disrespectful to this industry, but often the loans that they're giving are loans that were handled in the past by people like the mafia, where somebody needed a few hundred bucks and they charged really high interest rates to get the money, and maybe even had really aggressive collection tactics. I don't think anybody's legs are getting broken anymore, but really aggressive collection tactics as part of the business model.
Later in the hour, we'll speak with a representative from the payday loan industry. We'll talk to a reporter who's been investigating payday loan and other short-term credit options. And we'll also talk to someone who's been working on a local level to get legislation passed to regulate the payday loan industry. But first, Thomas, it's our regular segment, Beyond the News.
This week, our guest commentator is Michael Mandel. Michael, up until recently, was the chief economist at Business Week. He now is a blogger and is the editor-in-chief of a business called Visible Economy. I asked Michael if the newly announced R&D tax credits and other ideas that President Obama has will help stimulate jobs and jumpstart the economy.
Well, I don't think it's actually going to make all that much of a difference. Remember, we've had the R&D tax credit for quite a while at this point. What he's really proposing, or seems to be proposing, is making it permanent, which people have wanted for a long time. But at the end of the day, I actually think that that's the least significant portion of his program.
What is the most significant portion of his program?
Well, the part that's going to make the biggest difference, which talks about giving companies a tax break if they invest in the short run. That is to say, right now, small businesses get the right to write off their expenses, their capital expenses right away. Big business has it have to depreciate, which the president is suggesting is that anybody who invests now, anybody coming to invest in the U.S. now, can write it off their taxes right away. And what that means is that there's going to be an incentive that if you think you might invest down the road, if you think you might build a building or a factory or a shopping mall, you'd probably be better off doing it right now. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to pull the investment from the future into the present.
Well, given the conservative mood of businesses and the fact that many large companies have an awful lot of cash on hand, is that going to be incentive enough for them to take any action?
In some cases, it will be. In some cases, companies will say, I've got the cash on hand. It's not going to cost me. I was thinking about making an investment after the recession is over. Let me start it now. I do worry that it doesn't distinguish real well between good investments and bad investments. I worry that we're going to end up with sort of more shopping malls, that there's going to be incentive for construction companies or developers that want to build, you know, more things we don't really need, we'll have an incentive to start them now. You know, in some ways, it's a little bit like what conservatives have been sort of asking for, which is more incentive for businesses to invest. But frankly, if I was the president, I might have actually have gone all the way and asked the question, do we really need the corporate income tax anymore? Maybe what we need to do, is sort of say, this is rather than just giving this succession of weird tax breaks, why don't I say, he could have taken a big step and say, okay, let's get rid of the corporate income tax.
That seems that would probably have put the Republicans in quite a bind, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think it would, actually. I mean, if you take a step back, what the president is proposing is he's proposing more infrastructure spending, making the R&D tax credit permanent, this big capital investment tax break. I don't really think that any of these address the big underlying issues, which is whether or not the U.S. is innovative, whether or not we're doing enough intangible investment. It's kind of a compendium of big money spending that might juice up the economy for a bit, but I'm not sure have a real long-run impact.
Well, you know, one of the things that I wonder about is that, again, this is something focused towards larger businesses. It seems that small businesses still are stuck, and aren't small businesses really the growth engine as far as employment is concerned in the U.S. economy?
The small businesses are the growth engine in employment. It's actually more closer to that young businesses are the growth engine. From that point of view, I think that one of the biggest things that the president could do is adopt some sort of regulatory reform. I mean, I've got an idea that I call counter-cyclical regulatory policy, and the idea here is rather than pump more money into the economy, you sort of say, look, we're being strangled by a lot of red tape, and it seems to be more and more all the time. And yeah, and a lot of these regulations are good, but in bad times like now, maybe we want to relax a bit, take a step back, be a bit more permissive, and perhaps even not pass more.
So what is an example of some of the rules that the president could relax that would help small and what you call new businesses, which I think you're right, to have a little breathing room?
The way that I think about it is I think about throwing pebbles into a stream, and one pebble doesn't dam up the stream, and two pebbles don't dam up the stream. But, you throw enough pebbles in, and all of a sudden you've got a big mountain that slows down the stream, maybe diverts it, maybe it stops running. And so I think that you need to have a more permissive, relaxed attitude across a whole range of things. I'd also like to see him focus on all the regulations that he has coming in. For example, the Department of Education has these new sets of rules that they proposed for for-profit educational institutions, which would basically force them to guarantee to their students that there was a market for the stuff that they were being trained for. On one level, that's all well and good. On the other level, what we'll do is actually it'll mean that a lot of people who are going to school now won't end up going to school. And a lot of educational businesses will have a tough time making their way because they'll have to prove things that nobody can prove. And so what I would suggest right now to the president is look at the things that are on your plate regulation-wise that people are pushing for and decide to take a step back from them. Same thing on some of the healthcare regulations that are sort of going into place for small businesses. Take a look, make sure that they're delayed, that they don't hit so hard. This requires really a pretty good combing across everything that's going on. And I'm not talking about deregulation here, because in a lot of these cases, the basic idea behind the regulation is good. What I'm talking about is take a step back in the tough times that we are now and don't keep loading on more burden to people. And I think that this would be right now more effective than spending more money.
Well, I certainly could find a lot of support on the Republican Party for that. Let me ask you one last question, which is, so you've been watching economies for a long time. Do you see anything that gives you any indication that the economy is going to start moving more upward than it is, rather than a slow growth? Or are we on a long-term slow growth trajectory?
Well, traditionally, what drives economies like the U.S. forward is innovation. Right now, we've got innovation in the communications sector, and actually that sector is going forward and growing, and I'm talking about the Googles and the Apples and the app developers and the Verizons and the AT&Ts and the Comcasts and the big and small and all the developers around them. And this is a very vibrant sector, and it's actually been adding jobs, and it's what gets all the attention. And it's really very important. And so that's one source of growth. The other source of growth, which I'm actually sure is going to hit one way or the other over the next 5 to 10 years, which is that we as a country have invested an enormous amount in biosciences on the science side, on the research side. We haven't gotten the payoffs yet that we expected, but they could be right around the corner. And that would be, I almost hate this phrase. It's very trite, but it's perfectly true in this case. That could be a real game changer. Because big leaps forward in biosciences could affect the cost of healthcare, could afford the cost of aging, could affect the cost of food and the cost of energy. And so I'm actually optimistic in the medium term and even in the long term. Short term, not so much.
Well, Mike, thanks for being part of Business Matters today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Tom.
Our guest this week on Beyond the News has been Michael Mandel. He's a writer and blogger at South Mountain Economics, and the editor-in-chief of Visible Economy. You can find a link to his blog at our website, businessmatters.net.
So now down to this week's program. We're talking about the business of payday lending, a place where people can go get small amounts of money for short terms. The problem is, some of these short terms aren't so short, and sometimes people get themselves in over their heads because they're making these loans at many locations around town. So it seems like this is a growing challenge in America, particularly with the economy being in such a difficult situation.
So we wanted to find out, how does the industry see itself, and what is the value that it feels that it's providing to consumers? So we invited on someone from the Community Financial Services Association. That's the CFSA. They're the trade group for payday lenders. And we spoke to Samantha Soleveld, and she's one of the spokesperson for them.
And I asked Samantha why her industry has been the focus of so much anger.
Oftentimes I found that our critics tend to be members of associations who happen to support large financial institutions and big banks. And, you know, of course, they would love to see this industry go away if it meant that they would be able to charge a higher fee for a similar service that we provide. There's a lot of preconceived notions of the service because of the media that it gets, because of the way people who have never used a payday loan try to describe the product in terms of APR, which you might see quite frequently in the news. APR, when you think about it, is just not an appropriate measure for a payday loan, which is a two-week loan. So these are loans that are operating on two-week terms, you know, so they really can't be offered at the same rate that an annual credit product would be. So when you compare it to something like that, yes, the APR does sound higher, a lot higher, but that's because this is a much shorter term of a loan.
So because of the term, then the rates seem to be appropriate from your standpoint. But let me go back and just want to reference something you said a minute ago, which is that the banks, these large banks and the associations represent these banks are sort of taking shots. But it's my understanding that many of these same banks actually provided a lot of the funding that got this industry really going. So it seems there's a conflict between what you said and what some of their practical stories are about how the whole industry got working.
Yeah, I mean, there are some banks that offer similar products. Obviously, we welcome competition. Credit unions also offer short-term products as well, but they're all different. In many cases, a payday loan is oftentimes just more accessible than some of the other products that banks might offer, that credit unions might offer. We certainly welcome additional competition. We want consumers to have as many choices as they can have in order to make sure that they can make the best decision for themselves.
Now, you guys are doing some consumer education things, and you're trying to help consumers it looks to me like almost not need payday loans. They can operate more responsibly with the money that they have. So what's the motivation behind that?
Well, you know, I mean, we want to make sure that people, our customers, are making the right decisions for themselves. So, you know, of course, our service is not the right thing for everyone in every situation. So we want to make sure that they're going to use it responsibly and wisely. And because of that, we want to make sure that they understand what it is this service is, exactly what is involved, trying to provide them with the wisest solution for them. Because, again, these are small dollar loans. So, you know, consumers should only come to us when they are in need for a small dollar.
Consumers should only come to a payday loan service if they need a small amount of money. If they need something more than a few hundred dollars, they should find other sources for that money.
Correct. I mean, we represent the storefront payday lenders. You know, customers use payday advances to cover small, unexpected expenses between paydays. These are people who have a bill to pay today, and they need to choose between bouncing a check or paying overdraft fees, late payment penalties, or credit card late fees, and that kind of thing. You know, we could be talking about car repairs, home renovations, electricity bills that you just can't ignore. So what we want is to make sure that they're coming to us for the right reason and that they are using our service responsibly.
Right. Now, the industry itself has been growing quite a bit, right?
Looking at last year's study, it looks like the growth rate at this point is about 5 to 10%.
Do you expect this trend of growth to continue? Really, for me, it's a question that I'm looking at. How much a part of people's lives will you become? Will you become a bigger part of people's lives because they're more strapped for cash? Do you think that you'll become less because they're getting more savvy with their money? What do you guys see as a future trend for the industry?
At this point, I mean, there's a high demand for short-term credit in the country. Last year, we serviced up to 19 million customers. And, I mean, I think the need to have access to short-term credit is certainly growing. You know, it's just a nice option to have, and payday loans are a well-regulated short-term credit option. I think that as far as how much it's going to grow in the future, I can't really say. I'm not sure. I don't have the...
Okay. Well, let me ask you something about... It's okay. And let me ask you something about the regulations that are being proposed, and some of the consumer advocacy groups, different than industry advocacy groups, are asking for more regulation. Do you think more regulation is needed? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, the payday loan industry is highly regulated at the state level. We operate in 33 states right now, and we are, you know, continuously working with the state legislators to make sure that payday loans are offered, you know, responsibly, and that it's allowing consumers to have access to, you know, another financial option. As far as whether or not more legislation is needed, we're of the mindset that that's not really the case. The Bureau for Consumer Financial Protection is in the works. And, you know, we don't really see the need to have additional regulation on this industry, especially because it's just, you know, it's a very small dollar loan market. And the way that it's operating right now is going pretty well.
So there are some consumer advocates that say we have a need for national regulation beyond what's currently on the books, even with the Consumer Protection Agency being in formation, because the way these laws are applied are so different. You know, in New York City, a check cashing organization can only charge less than 2% for their check cashing services, while one in Kansas can charge as much as 10% because it's not regulated at all. So there's some disparity across the country, and the guy in Manhattan can still make money while the person in Kansas City is making tons of money. So
right.
Some people would say that's taking advantage of the consumer. So is there a place for some good consumer protection to produce consistency, even though most of the people that are doing this business are probably honorable people? Some people aren't.
I mean, it's true, but I mean, at the state level, you know, there are some disparities across states, but the way that the industry operates and the fact that we can work with state legislators at the state level, it allows us to get you know, closer with the consumers. The state regulators, you know, are more familiar with their citizens and what their needs are. And so it's hard to set a completely consistent law.
We do this with banking. We do this with lending. So we have national rules. We have usury laws that are national now, not just local, because of the disparity across the state. So if we're doing this with large amounts of money, why wouldn't we want to do the same thing with small amounts of money?
Well, banks and larger financial institutions are just that. They're far larger. And, you know, with the pending the legislation that they're putting in place, the bureau that they're putting in place is meant to address those larger financial institutions who were initially responsible for causing this, you know, subprime mortgage crisis, for causing this kind of financial meltdown. And, you know, short-term loans, specifically payday loans, really didn't contribute to that in any way. So to include them under that umbrella would not be accurate and wouldn't really be appropriate. And so, you know, like I said before, the way that the industry operates right now at the state level is working just fine, and there really is no need to have additional regulation at this point.
We've been speaking with Samantha Soloveld. She's a media representative for the CFSA. That's the trade group for payday lenders, the Community Financial Services Association of America. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk to a reporter who has investigated the payday lending industry. You're listening to Business Matters. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Business Matters. This is Thomas White.
And this is Jonah Meadows. And today we're talking about payday loans, short-term loans that you pay a fee on. They are the lenders of last resort. And our next guest is Gary Rivlin. He's been a reporter for the New York Times, the East Bay Express, the Chicago Reader. And his latest book is Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business.
I asked Gary, what was it that drew him to the subject of payday lending?
I saw that we were going into hard economic times, and I really wanted to pay attention to these businesses. Pawnbrokers is another one I throw in there, rent-to-own, for whom bad times is actually good economic times. I mean, this is this upside-down world where people who have no money in their pockets is good for business. You don't go to the pawnbroker if you got cash in your pocket. You go to the pawnbroker when you're broke. You go to the payday lender because your paycheck's not coming until next Wednesday and you have bills that need to be paid today. And so I just thought it'd be really interesting to explore this world and try to figure out who are some of the people behind this. I mean, who wakes up one day and says, oh, I know how I'm going to make my million and make my mark. I'm going to get rich, you know, making these short-term expensive loans to, you know, single moms with two kids making $20,000 a year as a waitress. And I just thought it'd be a perfect time to be exploring the world of subprime financing and fringe financing.
So, but looking at these check cashing payday advance businesses, you know, for a long time in our country, those services were provided by the mafia at those particular rates. So what was it that drew businesses in to start legalizing something that only criminals in our country had been doing?
Right. So you know, the payday lending only dates back to 1993 or so. And there are a few cases of people doing it here and there, but it became a big business in the 1990s. And, you know, the business world, there was just an opportunity. And I tracked down Alan Jones, the first guy to see that there were, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to be made in payday lending. And I genuinely believe that he began thinking he was doing something that would be a good. What do you do if you're a custodian at the local school, you work in a factory, not making, you know, you're making $20,000, $30,000 a year? What do you do if you don't have a rich uncle and you don't have a credit card and your car breaks down and you can't get to work? Without it, you need the $300, and you need it now to keep your job. So Alan Jones and others actually saw themselves as providing a service, and theoretically, they do. The payday loan does make sense. It is an option for those who don't have the kind of alternatives that more prosperous people have. The problem with it is that the person who's so desperate for $300 today that they'll pay fees, $45 in fees, you know, again, it works out to 400% of the year annual interest rate. How are they going to have the extra $345 in 2 weeks on top of their usual bill? So what happens is, even according to the payday lending industry, people typically take 2 or 3 months to pay these loans back. So you could borrow $300 and end up paying $200 in fees for the loan, if not more.
So I could see why somebody would say, you know, I want to help out and do this. And so they could make a reasonable business model, but now they're really we're dealing with the desperation and desperation of people that don't have any alternatives, as you say. So let's walk through, how does this work? Somebody walks into one of these places. What kind of process do they go through to get their money?
Right. So the first time you'd come in, you don't have a relationship with Advance America, Check and Go, Check into Cash. Those are three of the bigger chains out there. They'll need to see that you have a bank account. These are not the unbanked. They're not the people who go typically to a check cashing place. People, you know, go to check cashers don't have typically a bank account. You go to a payday lender, you need a bank account, and you need a regular paycheck. It could be a government check. Nowadays, it could be an unemployment check. But you need to have a regular check, because what they're doing is making you a loan against the money you'll get in 2 weeks. So you go in qualified because you have your paycheck and you have your bank account, and you write a post-dated check. You borrow $300, you're going to owe $345. You write a check for $345, and presumably in 2 weeks when the money is due, that check will now be good, and the payday lender will get their money. What's really interesting is, once you have the relationship established, then it's 5 minutes. After work, before you pick up the kids or groceries, you can borrow in just 3-5 minutes the $200 or $300 or $400. They've made it really easy and really convenient once you've established the relationship.
So I go in, and the thing that's interesting about this is the post-dated check. So I'm doing something that's in some ways illegal, right? To write a check for the money that I hope will be there, but may or may not be there?
Well, you're putting your finger on an important point, because the Congress and President Obama signed a bill that creates a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And there are some consumer advocates who want that agency to take on that very issue, that the very nature of a payday loan is an illegal act. To write a check that you know is not good, but, you know, the harmed party in this case would be the payday lender, and they're the ones who want you to write the check. I mean, this is really, really big business. I mean, these loans are typically $300-$400 at a time. But last year, there were more than $40 billion in payday loans, and the payday lenders collected around $7 billion in fees. So, you know, they're not really going to complain about a technicality like that.
Well, of course not. It's to their advantage, and it's to the disadvantage, because if this payday lender then doesn't have the money in the bank and the check bounces, what's the consequence for that person?
They'll just call and call and call. When you take out the loan, one piece I did leave out, you leave references. So you leave the phone number at your job. You leave the names and numbers of 3 or 4 references. And if suddenly they call up the bank and the money isn't there, they're going to call you. And then they're going to call you again and again and again. And then some chains are going to visit your house. And very soon they're going to start calling, you might use the word harassing, all the people you put down as references. And, you know, I spoke to a whole lot of people who started the business, people who are store managers, people who left because they didn't like it, and, you know, a load of customers. But it was also interesting, I spoke to a few people who were put down as references, and they ended up paying the loan on behalf of their sister, their friend, whoever it may be, just to stop the phone calls from coming to their work. So, you know, it's more that they pester rather than sending a lawyer after you, because again, it's typically $300 or $400 that you owe.
So they have the right to call your references over and over and over again because you're not paying something. Can the references say, stop calling me? The same kind of protections that people have in the consumer credit side?
Yeah, again, we're in a gray area. One thing to keep in mind about payday lending or pawn or check cashing or most of these you know, Poverty Inc. businesses, as I call them, that I wrote about, they fall under state statute. So there are some federal laws, you know, truth in lending, consumer protection laws that apply. But for the most part, it's the state. So it really depends on where you are. There's huge variability. So then what it comes down to for me is, what kind of profits are you making? And that's, in the end, what troubled me about the subprime mortgage lenders, the subprime credit card issuers, or some of the more of these fringe financiers. They're making so much more profit off the working poor, those living on the economic margins, the single mom working as a housekeeper at a big hotel making $20,000 a year. They're making two or three times the profit margin on those people compared to the more prosperous white-collar people. You know, the subprime credit card business started by these intrepid entrepreneurs who say, hey, let's give credit cards to people with lousy credit. And the big banks, the J.P. Morgan Chases of the world, saw the kind of profits these entrepreneurs were making, two or three times what they were making on their more traditional customers. So J.P. Morgan Chase, et cetera, all got into the business to make the money. So it's really the rate of profit rather than the fact that they're doing businesses in these communities.
And it's such an important point, because when you talk to these folks, they'll bemoan their high loss rates, and that's why they have to charge these rates and so forth. But the truth's always in the profit. Not in what my risk is and what I'm charging. It's how much money am I making? And these people are all making really great money. So who's the big players in the business today?
So the biggest chain is called Advance America. They've got like around 2,500 stores around the country. It was co-founded by somebody who'd worked in the Clinton White House, and after a few years of public service really wanted to make a lot of money and was just casting about for a business that would allow him to do that. He wanted, as he told me, Billy Webster is the fellow's name, he wanted to bring a Walmart kind of bigness to a field, and the payday lending industry was just ripe for that. And also what's interesting is these businesses, the payday lending business started, as I mentioned before, in 1993, yet by 2006, there were more payday lenders in this country than they were, excuse me, more payday lending stores in this country than there were McDonald's and Burger King's combined. That's how ubiquitous they had gotten. How did they get so ubiquitous? They had some of the biggest banks in the country making loans. So Advance America, before they opened a single store, had $50 million in loans from Wells Fargo was one of their funders, Wachovia Bank, Nations Bank, you know, big name brand banks. And so you see these big banks and also big Wall Street investment banks played a key role. Morgan Stanley, one of the most well-regarded names on Wall Street, they brought Advance America public. Goldman Sachs, they put huge lines of credit, tens of millions of dollars available to some of the most aggressive and, I would say, abusive subprime credit card issuers. And that was something really interesting that I didn't expect when I began this. I knew what big business it was, but I didn't realize how mainstream these businesses were.
Well, they really are. And so has that changed with the banking collapse? Are these big banks still involved in providing funding to this business sector?
Well, a lot of the funding was seed capital. And, of course, once the company came public, then the role of a Morgan Stanley would not necessarily – they wouldn't necessarily keep up the relationship. But what I think is interesting that I've seen happen is that – big banks are beginning to realize that this could hurt their reputation. One little business we haven't spoken about, I say little business, it's $3 or $4 billion a year, is the tax refunds business, these tax mills that they'll do your tax forms for you and give you your refund that day or the next day rather than waiting 2 or 3 weeks for the IRS to send you your refund. The biggest lender in that arena was J.P. Morgan Chase. And they just announced earlier this year that they're getting out of what's called a refund anticipation loan business. I think they just saw that it could damage their reputation, and banks have had their reputation damaged plenty in the last couple of years.
Well, you really state the problem so succinctly. It's one of those things like, my gosh, so what's happening in the regulatory space to try to put some reins on this? And are those regulations being effective?
Well, we're catching a system as it's changing. Part of the financial reform package aims at some of these fringe businesses. So clearly much of it was aimed at big banks, the so-called too big to fail. But at the same time, they implemented new rules about subprime credit card lending and established this Consumer Financial Protection Agency. It was just formed. It's in the Federal Reserve, but it's independent, has a independent director who is yet to be named, and it's going to have an independent source of funding. And its mandate is to monitor this range of financial products, from mortgages and subprime credit cards to payday loans. The devil's in the details, though. How much power are they actually going to have? And there are some limits, a cap on the interest rate that these lenders could charge. Most states have a usury cap, a limit on the annual interest rate a lender can charge. The payday lenders, though, in the 90s and early 2000s, spending lots of money in campaign contributions and on lobbyists, got exemptions from these existing laws around the country, their logic being, well, these are two-week loans, we charge a fee, it's not really an interest rate, we're providing this emergency product. There's been a real backlash against that, and you have some consumer advocates wanting Congress to create a 36% usury cap for the entire country. There is nothing like that. There's been proposals, but they haven't really gotten anywhere. So I would say that there's the promise of further regulation, but laws haven't gone nearly as far as the consumer advocates want. And there is this structural problem that pawnbrokers, check cashers, payday lenders, this whole range of businesses, they fall under state jurisdiction. So it's basically been state by state that this fight is being waged.
Well, as you pointed out in something I think you wrote, where they had big laws that passed, the industry just found a different way to operate. So they're very adept at dealing with regulatory changes and not being eliminated, but simply just making it more interesting.
Ohio wanted to take away the exemption from the existing usury cap that they had granted the payday lenders. That passed. The governor signed it. The next day, the payday lenders put a ballot initiative to undo the law that was just passed. The state of Ohio, in November of 2008, voted overwhelmingly, almost 2-1, to uphold the 28% rate cap on the payday lenders. And so instead, they are charging 28%, but now they have a $10 or $15 application fee, and they have a $10 credit check fee. Some of the more ambitious are giving people their payday loan in the form of a check and then charging them money, a la check casher, to cash the check. And, you know, lo and behold, pretty much the exact same fee that they had been charging before the state changed the law. And so now the state legislature is trying again to close down these loopholes and, you know, finally put the payday lenders out of business.
We've been speaking with Gary Rivlin. His latest book is Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. You can find more information about Gary and a link to his website at our website, businessmatters.net.
Next up on the program, we go from understanding the problem to doing something about it. Before we do that, though, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Business Matters. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Business Matters. I'm Jonah Meadows.
This is Thomas White. Today's program is about the business of payday lending, something we call legalized loan sharking. Typically, this industry, up until 10 years ago or 15 years ago, was serviced by the sort of the, what we would call the seedy side of the world, people that were doing these kinds of loans under the table. Now it's big business, and some of these companies are even very large public companies. So we talked about what the challenges are, but what are people doing about this? So we wanted to go and talk with someone who's leading a campaign for reform, understand what the issues are on a more personal basis, and what can be done about it. So we invited Linda Delafort. She's the Associate Director of the Citizen Action for Illinois. She served as the Executive Director of a National Food Safety Group and been really involved in consumer action activities.
So Citizens Action Illinois has been working to try to reform payday lending laws over the past decade, and I wanted to find out how it all began. So I asked Linda, how did their campaign for payday lending reform get started?
Well, our work began in 1999 when Monsignor John Egan, who was an activist Catholic priest here in the Chicago area, answered the call of a parishioner from Holy Name Cathedral here in Chicago. The woman was in desperate circumstances. She had two payday loans out at the same time, each with an annual interest rate of 521%. She was in what we would call a debt trap. She had been paying on these loans for months, basically using the money from one loan to pay the other off and back and forth, and had never been able to get out of the cycle of debt. So she approached Father Egan, who personally helped raise the $700 that she needed to pay off the loans, went to the south side of Chicago with her to pay the loans off, and then he picked up the phone, as Monsignor Egan was wont to do, and got busy organizing. He called a number of leaders in the Chicago area that he had worked on over the years on consumer and civil justice campaigns, and my organization, Citizen Action Illinois, was one of those organizations that was called to the table, as well as a number of others in the Chicago area, the Woodstock Institute, Metropolitan Family Services, and state leaders who he thought, Monsignor Egan thought, might care about this issue. Certainly our Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, who was a state senator at that time, attended many of the meetings set up by the Monsignor, as well as State Senator Barack Obama. He sat at the table with us in the early days when we first began this campaign.
So at the time, that was about 10 years ago, was there any coalition that was organizing to keep tabs on or to regulate the payday lending industry at the time?
No, we were the first in Illinois, and I think one of the first in the country. Illinois was a little bit different than some other states. Essentially, in the late 1970s, when prime interest rates rose in the 20% range, a lot of states at that time eliminated or relaxed regulations on consumer credit. Some states actually modified laws so that rates would fluctuate with the published market interest rate. And most states just raised their rates to around 36%, which was thought to be a point that was not binding on the traditional, you know, banking lenders. Unfortunately, Illinois was one of the states that took the action of just totally eliminating all rate caps on smaller loans. With that action over the next decade and a half, developed the payday loan model that we really saw take fire in about the mid-1990s. So at the same time that we were gearing up as a consumer advocacy coalition, we also saw the industry in Illinois start to gear up and create their own associations for lobbying on their behalf in the legislature.
Seems like the argument of the industry is often that the big banks and even community banks, it's not worth it for them to process all these small loans because of the administrative fees. And so they argue they're filling this necessary niche that to serve a consumer that's not going to get any sort of lending anywhere else.
You know, we've always said that people need access to fair credit. I mean, you know, when you think about it, credit is the lifeblood of our economy. It's how we've traditionally paid for our cars, our homes. It's how we send our kids to college. But what we don't need is access to predatory lines of credit, which strip people of assets, dignity, send them into courts, into bankruptcy. And so certainly, you know, when traditional lenders leave a community, we see predatory loan sharks move in. And, you know, when you have a set of state regulations and, you know, we saw it certainly even at the federal level on the mortgage issue, you have predatory lenders move in. So it doesn't, yes, people need access to credit. And yes, we should be doing everything we possibly can to give them access to credit, particularly low-income folks, because it's really the bad loans, the high-cost loans, are extended most frequently to the low-income individuals, minorities, elderly women, especially single women. Our studies have shown over two-thirds occupy the lowest three income occupations as a laborer, office worker, or benefit recipient. These are the people who turn to these types of predatory products. And several studies, including studies that we've conducted here in Illinois, have shown that African Americans are disproportionately payday loan borrowers. So yes, we need to do a better job as a community in establishing access to credit. Hopefully, under some of the new schemes that are coming out under the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we'll start to see some movement in that area. Plus, you know, I also think that there have been a number of local initiatives, especially in the Chicago area, with credit unions reaching out and trying to provide these types of loans to people. And then, frankly, I mean, we would, you know, advocate that people really, you know, we teach our kids how to build assets. Consumer Federation of America, I know, points to data which shows that families making $25,000 a year are 8 times more likely to take out a payday loan when they have no savings as compared to if they can just figure out how to put $500 in your savings account. So there are a lot of alternatives. But, yeah, when they're not out there, then the sharks move in. And that's certainly what we've seen over the last decade. Now, we've also seen a tremendous movement across the nation in regulating these products. And that certainly has been a 10-year struggle for us here in Illinois.
So when a policymaker is trying to come up with what's the right way to regulate this, how do you draw the line between fair credit and predatory lending? I mean, is there a specific interest rate or something to do with how many days you have to pay it back? What's the best way to draw the line and say this is when it becomes predatory?
Yeah, I mean, in all of our negotiations and attempts to create safe consumer products in Illinois, the Egan Coalition set up a kind of some criteria that we felt was important for loans. One is that the lender always should look at what their borrower's ability to repay that loan is. And one of the traps of a payday loan is that there is no consideration, there's no underwriting, there's no consideration or very little consideration on the part of the lender as to what that person's real ability is to repay that loan. Certainly there should be limits on rates. Many of the national consumer advocates would argue that 36% is a fair rate. It's the rate that we set for military personnel at the federal level. Senator Durbin here in Illinois has advocated for a 36% rate cap. So certainly rates are part of it. You can't have an endless cycle of debt. It's not just the high rates that get people in trouble when they take out these types of loans. It's the fact that they can never pay the loan off. They just get in this cycle of debt that doesn't stop. I'll give you one example of a gentleman who approached me. He took out a payday loan for $250, 80-year-old gentleman. He lived on $1,300 a month Social Security. He made 5 monthly payments of $87, which only covered the interest. When he got to the final payment, he owed the full principal plus the interest for the month. We call that a balloon payment. It's a debt trap. He couldn't come up with the $337 he needed to pay off the loan. So what did he do? He rolled it over. And then he went through this cycle 3 times. So within a year and a half, Mr. Webb had paid almost $2,000 just to borrow $250. That's the debt cycle. And then, of course, we believe in strong enforcement. This industry should not be allowed to police itself. We've advocated for very strong consumer reporting services where data is entered and collected and gathered, and our state regulators can use that data for enforcement provisions.
So one of the results of your organizing was to pass a new law in Illinois. Could you explain what that law is and what sort of new regulation it puts on the industry?
Yeah, we've actually passed more than one new law in Illinois. In 2005, we passed our first Payday Loan Reform Act, it was intended to rein in the most egregious practices. But the industry in Illinois and across the nation has been known to find loopholes to get around regulations, and they found a pretty big loophole in Illinois. So they created a new product under a different licensing scheme. And so then we basically ended up with a situation where most of the lenders in the state of Illinois were not complying with the 05 law, but were offering products under a different license, under their consumer installment loan license. So we had to go back to the drawing table, and actually took us another 5 years to pass the law, which Governor Quinn most recently signed this summer, which actually will go into effect in March of 2011. So we had to go back and take a look at all of a broad spectrum of loans, from longer-term consumer installment loans to shorter-term payday loans, and make sure that those negotiating principles that I've laid out would apply to all of these different loan products. And so the new law will apply to longer-term installment loans as well as shorter-term payday loans. It will set reasonable rates for the shorter-term payday loans. Those rates are going to be a little higher. For the longer-term loans, they're going to be lower. We've eliminated that balloon payment option in Illinois. There will no longer be a lender who's allowed to do that balloon payment, where you have to pay off the final amount in principal all at once. We have ended the practice of penalizing borrowers for who want to pay off loans early in Illinois, and we have a new set of criteria for limiting monthly payments to a certain percentage of your gross monthly income, of course, we want to make sure that people get out of that debt cycle. So there are some provisions in there to end that cycle of debt, and all of this will be enforced by a consumer reporting service that all the industry will have to comply with, and will have to enter information about the various loans. We hope at that point that the information that we'll be able to collect will allow for better transparency as to how these loans actually affect consumers, and will also give us information should we have to come back and provide more protections. We'll have a base of good information upon which to build what we hope would be better public policy.
So after this new law comes into effect next year, how is regulation in Illinois going to compare with the levels of regulation in other states?
Oh, well, I mean, when we started this campaign 10 years ago, we advocated for across-the-board rate cap of 36%. Mm-hmm. After years of negotiations with industry representatives and policymakers, it became pretty clear that this rate cap was something that would obviously do harm to the profitability of the industry, situation which we as consumer advocates could live with, but many others probably could clearly not live with that. So on our part, this is a compromise here in Illinois. Some states have moved much farther than us and have banned the product entirely, or have moved to eliminate the product, probably most recently in state of Colorado, state of Washington. So we've tried to create a situation here where the product is available to people should they have to resort to it. We don't recommend it, but that there are protections out there that if you do use this product, you're not going to end up in bankruptcy or in a court or in an endless cycle of debt. Now, we'll see how, we've never had a chance to see if these protections really work, because, as I mentioned, the 05 Act had a loophole which the industry got a hold of and pretty much drove a Mack truck through. So we'll see how things go in March of 2011 and whether we're able to really close that loophole and effectively get a product out there on the market that's both good for consumers and yet allows what I would think would be some of the better lenders in Illinois to stay in business. I think the bad apples won't be able to do their work under this law, but, the better lenders who really may want to provide a safe product, which is what we would hope they'd want to do, would be able to survive. But we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I can tell you that there are lenders in the state of Illinois already that are lobbying for changes in the law, and it hasn't even gone into effect yet. It's a very powerful industry across the nation. They've spent an enormous amount of money in over the last year in Congress, attempting to, you know, stop a number of the reforms in the national financial reform bill. Here in Illinois, from the start of the industry in the late 90s through 08, the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform charted how much money they raised and gave to state and legislative officers here in Illinois between 2001 and 2008. That number was $1.8 million. So clearly, it's got a strong influence over our political process, and it's up to us to see if we can create an environment that is fair. And that's been the struggle here in Illinois. I don't think we know the answer to that yet. We'll see what happens come March.
So, Linda Delafork, thanks so much for being on Business Matters today.
Thank you, Joan. I appreciate the opportunity to share these thoughts, and I encourage everyone to save a little money and don't take out a payday loan.
We've been talking with Linda Delafork. She's the Associate Director of Citizen Action Illinois. You can find out more about Citizen Action Illinois and their activities on payday lending reform at our website, businessmatters.net. You may want to get involved in this issue in your state. You can go to our website and find out where other campaigns for reform for payday lending are going on all around America.
So that's it for this week's Business Matters. What do we have next week, Thomas?
Well, next week is kind of an interesting topic, because often we think about the word love in like romantic ways, or we think about it perhaps even sexuality, I guess. But next week we're going to find out about love being the centerpiece of successful businesses. You won't want to miss that program, I guarantee it.
We always love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us via email at feedback@businessmatters.net, where you can send any comments or suggestions or complaints about Business Matters. Again, our email address is feedback@businessmatters.net.
Today's program was produced and co-hosted by Jonah Meadows. Until next week, this is Thomas White.